Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Today, we have Dr. Adam White. Dr. White is the head of brain health at the Professional Footballers Association, the Players Union for Football in England, and a co-founder of the Concussion Legacy Foundation in the UK. Dr. White, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Can you tell us a little bit about your role in the PFA and how you became involved in brain health work in football?
Yeah, I think probably like most people, by accident. When I was much younger, I had no anticipation that I would end up in this space. I always really wanted to be what we would call a PE teacher in the UK. So someone that teaches sport within a school setting. That was my goal. And as part of that, rugby was my main sport. For those in America, rugby's the American football equivalent, where we don't keep stop starting and we lose the pads and we tackle each other, which is much more brutal in my view in some ways, and more intelligent in others. Like, we don't smash each other in the head as much, which is a positive. But I very quickly realized in my journey that there was this big issue around head injuries. We were seeing in young people, kids in schools that were being made to participate in contact rugby, that ultimately, it was one of the biggest injuries that we would see, is these concussions that were having a real impact upon young people. And so I wanted to study it more. I wanted to understand why we were putting children in schools through these contact sports, making them hit their heads and tackle each other really hard, which was causing all sorts of injuries. It's just a part of education. And so that's what really interested me. I did a PhD. I looked into this. And as part of that journey, what I found really fascinating was not just the kind of medical data, the evidence, whether that's the work that's been done at places like Boston University, looking at chronic traumatic encephalopathy, the numerous studies on concussion. You know, I thought the medical data was pretty comprehensive and I was sold on it at that time. But I thought what was really interesting is it wasn't really changing sport and why this kind of cultural phenomenon was taking place. And so that's what I was really interested in. And then also the voices of the people and the lives that this affects, because we can talk about medical conditions and quickly forget about these are athletes, they're people, they're brothers, they're fathers, they're husbands, and actually the profound impact that long-term effects of neurodegenerative diseases and CTE can have on that and the whole family. And so that's what got me interested, probably over a decade ago now. I then decided the best people to collaborate with internationally was the Concussion Legacy Foundation, now the Concussion and CTE Foundation. Dr. Chris Nowinski, I thought, was leading the way on this, and particularly in the United States. And at the time, I felt like the UK was 5 to 10 years behind the US in terms of the work that we were doing. And there was much less research. There was no education. There was no policy changes happening within the sports. There's very little public awareness. And so I collaborated with Chris and said, hey, look, I want to set up a Concussion Legacy Foundation in the UK. And he did. He let us. And so we went on that journey. And then back in 2021, in the UK, the Professional Footballers Association, which is the players association for soccer, started along a journey of, I guess, recognizing the challenges within football or soccer and addressing it. And so they set up what they called a neurodegenerative disease department at first. That felt like a mouthful, so they changed it to brain health. As part of that journey, they wanted someone to lead it, and I was the unlucky soul that got the role. And it's been brilliant. It's been great. We've been able to do some really cool things and ultimately actually make some real good change. I think that's the important part. You know, there are not many roles in the world of sport where you can turn around big leagues, big institutions so quickly. And I think we've been really lucky to be empowered to do that, which has been fantastic.
Looking to get back in the game and feel your absolute best? Boston Orthopedics and Wellness has you covered. At Boston Orthopedics and Wellness, they're all about helping you recover faster, re-energize your body, and truly revitalize your health. Whether you're dealing with an injury, looking for cutting-edge recovery therapies, or exploring innovative treatments for orthopedic conditions, their expert team is ready to guide you every step of the way. From advanced regenerative treatments like PRP, stem cell therapy, and peptides, to performance and wellness services like NAD Plus therapy, men's health optimization, and weight management programs, they offer a comprehensive, personalized approach to getting you back to peak performance. This isn't just treatment. It's a path to moving better, feeling stronger, and living pain-free. Boston Orthopedics and Wellness is where your comeback starts. Learn more and start your journey today at bostonorthopedicandwellness.com. You mentioned that your role is focused on brain health, and you're the head of brain health at Professional Footballers Association. So how are you defining brain health beyond just a concussion?
Yeah, so in fact, I think relatively we're not overly focused on concussion anymore. It feels like concussions are a problem of the past in some respects. And what I mean by that is over the last 20 or 30 years, there's been significant work across the whole world of sport, not just in football or soccer, to look at what is a concussion, make sure people are better educated, they can recognize the signs and symptoms, appropriate return to play protocols, all of that science, rehab, what do we do, and advise people on retirement guidance. You know, we've done tons. The world of sports medicine has been fantastic in this, in trying to really address the issue of concussion from, you know, 20 years ago, where people thought that, you know, you had to really be knocked out for a significant period of time to be concussed, to today, where, you know, any recognition of any signs and symptoms, a slight loss of balance, and et cetera, it is recognized. And I think we've done a really good job of that. In football, we're fairly comfortable with where we're at. But in terms of the issues that we're really focused on is that long-term risk to professional football players that we believe is associated with heading the football over and over and over and over again throughout their career. It's the thousands of repetitive head impacts that are non-concussive, they're non-symptomatic, that players are sustaining every day in training that we think are leading to these, and the evidence is pointing towards, are leading to this long-term set of neurodegenerative diseases. Often we're couching it as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, some motor neurons disease, or ALS as it is in the States. But for those that are studied post-mortem, we're overwhelmingly finding that they're being diagnosed pathologically with CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And so that's our focus. We're really lucky that we also have a separate well-being department that's able to focus on the mental health and well-being of athletes. So we've got a great team that deals with that side of things. And so we're really able to focus on kind of brain health from a much more structural medical side.
You know, it's quite interesting because we talk about, you know, American football, and that's the premier focus here in the United States. And you talk about European football, it's two different things, right? We're talking soccer to gladiator style football. And we talk about subconcussive impacts. And that's one of the biggest things we talk about, and how that has been one of the things that has come out in the media and in the news back to when Ted Johnson, former NFLer, was diagnosed with multiple injuries and came out in the media about his injury status. What are the biggest misconceptions about heading and subconcussive impacts with footballers?
I think initially everybody thinks it's concussion related. Mm-hmm. And I think we've had to shift the narrative that it's not just concussions. Of course they have a part to play, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily the concussions that are the problem. It's the players that are heading the ball the most where we're seeing this issue. And we've had some really good research studies. The field study from the University of Glasgow has been able to identify the greatest risks for players that in positions that head the ball the most. And frequently we've seen a repeated picture of that. I think the challenge or the biggest myth or challenge we have is football, our football, soccer, has exponentially developed over the last 50 years with professionalization. The game's become quicker. And traditionally, they played with this old leather ball that, particularly when it got wet, was able to soak up lots of water, was really heavy. And so immediately everyone thinks, oh, it must be that old leather ball that's causing these forces that are going through the brain. And when you compare it to today's footballs that are synthetic, they're waterproof, they're much better designed, everyone says or believes that that risk might have dissipated. But they forget some basic physics, and big, heavy leather balls don't travel very fast or very far, and they're really hard to kick. Whereas when you've got these nice synthetic balls that are made to be aerodynamic, they're traveling at much greater forces today than they ever were in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the players that we've been able to study. And so this problem should be getting worse in that respect. It should be the forces that are being translated through the players' brains' heads will be greater because of the ball dynamics. And then when you overlay that players are much stronger, fitter, faster than they ever have been, they're more technically skilled than they ever have been, they're able to send that ball with greater speed, with greater torque. And so it's a compounding issue if we look at it just through that lens.
One of the, I think, misconceptions that people also have that we talk about is it's not linear force, it's rotational force. And you see athletes try to hit and rotate as quickly as they can to redirect the ball. So are you seeing some of that data come out that is more supportive to help to educate the athlete more and the individuals that are caring for them, the stakeholders?
Yeah, I think, and we've been on a journey over the last couple of years, particularly to look at the forces around heading the ball. And you're absolutely right. We have kind of two areas of concern in football. One is those really long balls that are, you know, a goalkeeper kicks out or somebody clears it a long distance, and a player ultimately is looking to send that ball back. And so generally it's a fairly linear force. It's a great, you know, the it's come a long distance at speed, and therefore the forces going through the brain are significant. The other challenge is the set piece. It's those corners that we're seeing that everybody loves to score a goal, and the ball's sent in, and ultimately somebody's trying to put that ball on their head and then into a goal. And so we are seeing that rotational component to it, which is a real concern. Around a quarter of goals in football are scored from a header, and so we're never going to be able to lose that part of the game. It's just trying to get players to understand or think about how they do that in a different way, and whether there's ways they can position themselves differently. And if we can't, then it's about exposure and how do we train these athletes in a way that they're not sustaining it within the training environment. And so if we can keep it in the game, and we have to keep it in the game, which is what the players want, it's how can we adapt the training environment so they're not sustaining those rotational forces, the torque going through their skull, you know, which ultimately is causing a real strain on the axons within the brain.
For our American audience, most people are probably familiar with the NFL and the independent neurologist in the blue tent. Anytime an NFL player has a potential concussive episode, what are some of the similarities and differences between that approach to in-game concussion screening here in the United States versus on a football pitch in the United Kingdom?
Yeah, this is the one area where our football, soccer, needs to improve. And it's something that we've been lobbying for significantly over the last 3, 4, 5 years. So in the NFL or other sports, whether you look at rugby or pretty much every other sport that has a risk of concussion, if a player seems to have a hit or shows any signs and symptoms of a concussion, whether that's tight posturing or they're unsteady on their feet or whatever those signs might be, generally there's some form of the player can be withdrawn from the game temporarily. They can be assessed by a doctor, often using the sport concussion assessment tool or something similar. And if that player passes all of those assessments with no further signs or symptoms shown, then they're able to return to the game. And in the UK, rugby's been doing this for probably a decade now. They have been using team doctors rather than those independent neurologists that the NFL does. So there are some slight differences, but it has worked phenomenally. We see it means that there's a lower threshold for doctors to remove players. It means players are more happy to be removed because there's a potential chance that they can get back on the field. And it allows doctors and clinicians the time and space to do these assessments in an environment where they can recognize the subtle differences, whether it's around speech or, you know, because they know these players really well. And it's often with neurological complaints like a concussion that they will need to be able to recognize those subtleties. Soccer, however, has this frustrating reluctance to want to implement temporary concussion substitutions. And despite the union, the Players Association, the leagues, whether that's the Premier League, the English Football League, the governing body, the Football Association, everybody wants this. But FIFA and IFAB, the international lawmakers, are refusing it. They won't allow us to have this temporary concussion substitution. The players want it. The doctors want it. Everybody wants this. It makes sense. There's no other space other than war zones where we tell doctors, you've got to assess people in a really strict time zone, and that's it. You know, everywhere else, we let doctors do their jobs properly with the tools and resources that they need, and they're the people that are the most important, particularly when it comes to health. And yet football does this differently. And it's beyond frustrating, I think. And this is one space where everybody seems to agree that it's the right thing to do, except the international governing body.
You can hear the passion and frustration in your voice when you talk about it.
Yeah, it just makes no sense. And it's really, really frustrating. And it's really frustrating because for anyone that's been to just like going to an NFL game, the crowd is loud, the environment's hot. You know, it's not an easy place to operate as a clinician. And when you're trying to ask questions and get subtle responses from players, and you know, you can see it every week where there's a suspected concussion and the clinicians happen to lean down so close that their ear's next to the player's mouth. That means they're not able to watch what's going on at the same time because they're trying to listen. It means they're not able to hear them properly. Why can't we just take that player off for 10 minutes, take them to the medical room and allow them to assess them properly? And if that player's fine, let's just bring him back on. If they're not, the replacement's already happened, the game continues. And it would allow the game to flow much more than what we see is happening. Player gets a suspected concussion. Doctor spends 2 to 3 minutes trying to assess them on the field. Game restarts. Player stays on. 5 minutes later, it has to stop again because then the player comes off once they've recognized that, i.e. they're not performing anymore or they've spotted further symptoms. And so you get 2 stoppages rather than 1. It just doesn't make any sense to us whatsoever.
So it seems like it's more of a cultural change and an educational change than anything when it comes to being able to properly assess. Because I've worked when soccer has come to the United States for like the Gold Cup or the World Cup, I had the opportunity to work in those settings. And we had to abide by the medical rules for the European medical rules versus the US medical rules. So I can see where that would be challenging when you're trying, it's like trying to move mountains, you know, what you're trying to do.
Yeah, I think it's the fact that it's this, because everything's held under FIFA and they've got a particular view, which to some extent you can understand. The safest thing to do in a bubble would be anybody with a suspected concussion just immediately comes off. But that doesn't happen in performance sport. That doesn't happen when players and there's World Cups to win or the Premier League to win. It's just unrealistic in the performance environment. And we might not like that, but that's reality. It's culture and context. And the way around that, and all of the other sports have found the way around that, is allow the doctors to do the assessment, and then they can overrule it. And it's just a frustration. It's a massive challenge, you know, and we hope that FIFA and IFAB will revisit this and change the approach, and I hope they will.
Riz had mentioned our friend and former podcast guest, Ted Johnson, former linebacker for the New England Patriots, whose public disclosure of his injuries later in his career sort of prompted the NFL to start creating these protocol, and now it's prevalent across the entire league. Who are some of the high-profile players or visible figures in your sphere that have created this snowball into an avalanche for concussion awareness?
We haven't had too many of them in football. I think because of the environment, the nature of transfers, this isn't a topic that most people want to talk about, even post-career, which is frustrating. We need so many more people. We need those athlete voices talking about it. But I think if we're talking more broader brain health than concussion, it would be remiss not to talk about the story of Jeff Astle, former West Bromwich Albion player, played for England in the 70s. He was not just a great player, which I think is really important, but he was a really down-to-earth human being. He was loved by the fans. He was well-respected across the footballing community. And as well as being a phenomenal athlete. West Bromwich Albion, which was a top-tier team at the time, called him the king. He was loved by them. And when he, obviously, once he finished his career in his early 50s, he started to develop dementia. And at the age of 59, he died by choking to death at his daughter's birthday party, trying to eat a sandwich. And he subsequently became the first British football player to be, after his death, studied for CTE. And he was found to have CTE. There was a coroner's court hearing where the coroner referred to his brain of being the brain of a boxer rather than a footballer. And he was known for heading the ball. He was phenomenal in the air. And so I think it was a perfect storm, you know, this well-loved, heroic player that was classed as the king from a really important team. And then subsequently has CTE, has it early, has it really aggressively. The brain was present, all of it just lined up. But when that happened, his family are phenomenal. He's got three daughters and they basically took this on, and they went to the football authorities and they said, look, there's this issue. What are you doing about it? And they didn't get the response they wanted. And so they literally mobilized West Bromwich Albion fans, and they went on a massive campaign. They carried banners to every Premier League game that year. And they made football sit up and listen. And I think that's probably the most notable case is of Jeff Astle. And since then, you know, from that kind of foundational work, you know, a decade ago, we've seen numerous players now subsequently post their career, rather than hiding dementia or neurodegenerative conditions, have made it public. And so, you know, half of the 1966 World Cup winning team was subsequently diagnosed with a neurodegenerative condition. And we're just hearing more and more and more, you know, every week, really. So I think it's a changing picture. But the big challenge we have in the UK is lots of the former players are happy to talk about this in their later life, but the current players or recently retired players, it's difficult to get them talking on such a hot topic.
Now, do you think that's because of the fear of a stigma for them to be or have an injury that people can't see, versus something that somebody can see? Because we do talk about this in the United States a lot, especially with American football. There's that stigma. But also, is it also a fear of not being able to play the sport they love and earn a living doing?
Yeah, I think it's a mix of things. I don't think I could rule out the bits around stigma or masculinity or, you know, the kind of cultural components of play on through injury. I think that does have a role to play. And I think that's amplified when it's a invisible injury. If you've got a broken leg, you've got something that you can point to. But a concussion or post-concussion syndrome or any other neurological condition, you can't really point to it. It's not visible to everybody else. So I definitely think there's some of that. I definitely believe there's some of the kind of play on through injury, sporting ethic type challenge. But I also think it's the commercial world of football. I think players, particularly current players, are very conscious of their own worth and themselves as a commodity. And actually, if they're talking about concussions, are other clubs that are looking to purchase them in the future going to be saying, hang on a second, what's going on here? Is there a concussion? Is he going to have post-concussion syndrome? Are we going to have issues around heading the ball? And we are hearing stories of people saying, you know, will they duck away from headers or withdraw? And so it's definitely this perception, which I think players are very conscious of will it lower their value, their market value, and will it have issues about them getting their next contract? And so I think it's a mix of all of these things, whether it's the masculinity, the injury, being invisible, but also the kind of commercial landscape of football.
Now, what makes monitoring head impact exposures challenging for the stakeholders, for the medical staff, for you as a researcher? Like, what are some of those challenges and how do you get past that?
In soccer, it's a real challenge for us because everywhere else that's looking at this has some opportunities. So the NFL can put sensors in the helmet, which are able to register forces that are taking place. rugby, they wear mouth guards, which means they can put accelerometers and gyroscopes into the mouth guard to be able to measure those forces. But football players won't wear helmets or mouth guards. And so we're really struggling to be able to put a objective monitoring device onto players that will be able to register those head impacts. So at the moment, the only opportunities we really have is we can count the number of times they hit the ball, whether that's in training or in a game, often very manually. So we do know of some clubs that literally will have somebody with a clipboard and they will be tallying up headers. But other than that, we don't really have any solutions at the moment for monitoring head impacts in football. What we will be doing, and what I think is an opportunity, is around video and AI. We know that games and training and everything's recorded to the nth degree now. And so if we're able to use generative AI as a way of identifying head impacts and hopefully able to, through calculations and an algorithm, be able to identify the forces of those head impacts, that could be our solution.
And that was going to certainly be my follow-up, because we know that machine learning and markerless tracking for athletes is done at multiple levels of sports. And we could probably use that same type of algorithm to see the amount of G-forces that are sustained per impact, and you could have a threshold. Again, I think the hard part is going to be, what is everybody's threshold, right? You got to, you know, everybody's different. Like, Cam's is different than mine, it is different than yours. But how can you set a safe threshold to say that player A had 10 sub-concussive impacts in this contest that exceeded 8 Gs, and player B had 15 that exceeded 6 Gs, then what, do you take them at the end of the contest and examine them? I don't know. I think there's definitely a lot of room there for a lot of runway for that type of technology, but it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future for sure.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We have no idea what the safe thresholds are, and it's easier to find out what those thresholds might be that cause a concussion, because you would just, when you get concussions, you'd measure what the force was, and that would be great. But for those long-term risks, we have no idea at the moment. And so the one thing we do know is the more we can do to reduce it, the better. And so in professional football today, we have what we call the heading guidance. It's fully across all professional teams, whether that's the England team, the Premier League, right the way down. And we ask that players do no more than 10 high force headers per week. So those corner kicks to a header or those long balls, we expect that professional players will do no more than 10 of those in training per week. And so far, the feedback we're getting from players is that that's fairly well respected. Over 70% of players are adhering to that. The challenge is the positions where they have the ball a lot. So our central defenders are heading way more than that. And so there is room that we need to do. And I think our message, when we're able to appropriately measure the forces, we will still take the approach of, let's see what we can lower and how we can bring it down. And so we've got kind of four key principles that we talk about, which is less headers, doing them less often, with less force, and preferably later in life. And so if we can use those as guiding principles behind our kind of approach, we can use the data to try and bring that down as much as possible.
How's the association approaching long-term neurologic care for the players, especially after their retirement?
Yeah, I think, and this is a challenge, there are no great solutions. What we know from our data in soccer, unlike other sports, is there are a variety of modifiable risk factors for former athletes associated with neurodegenerative conditions. Footballers, however, score really well on all of them. And so they have great cardiovascular health. They don't smoke. They're generally very social. When you go down those modifiable risk factors, they're actually in really good places for all of them. Low diabetes, they're low blood pressure, low on stress and mental health. And so it doesn't actually give us much options around what we can do in those spaces. What we do, of course, we continue to promote them. You know, what's good for the heart is good for the head. And, you know, we would always promote good health advice to former players. But they're generally in pretty good condition anyway. And that's reflected also in the data in former professional football players are living much longer than the population. You know, we're seeing them die 7, 8, 9 years after comparative controls. So we obviously promote that. If we can bring down the heading risk, that'll be great as well. But we don't have huge solutions for neurodegenerative disease, so prevention's got to be key. But we do in the UK, we have what's called the Football Brain Health Fund. And so football has recognized that these guys have given their life to sport. They're really important. The fans love them. They're part of the heritage. And we can't just leave them at their time of need. We need to be there for them. And so the Premier League, the English Football League, and the Professional Footballers Association have put some money together. And basically any former players that have got a diagnosed neurodegenerative condition can apply for financial support for anything that helps improve their quality of life. And so whether that's care home fees, medical costs, assistance or carer assistance in the home, home adaptations, occupational therapy, physiotherapy, whatever it might be that's required to improve and enhance their quality of life, living with a neurodegenerative disease is supported. And so, and there are hundreds of players taking benefit of that. What's very different to the NFL concussion settlement is it has no lawyers. We've kept the lawyers away from it. We don't force them to go through medical assessments. I think the average time between application and receiving the support is less than 3 weeks. So it's very much a kind of social medical initiative rather than a kind of concussion settlement legal initiative. Because ultimately, people living with dementia and other conditions, they don't have time on their side. And so we didn't want to wrap them up in all this bureaucracy. We wanted to be able to offer them the support they need at the time they need it in the most humane, caring way possible.
All right, Dr. White, I've been waiting weeks to ask you about this. But you wrote an absolutely fascinating book called Sport Theory and Social Problems. And for those who haven't read it, it's a book that talks about how competitive sports can actually perpetuate social problems, inequality, violence, obedience to authority. So what motivated you to write this book?
Yeah, I think, thank you for reading it, firstly. Most people have to go to university and be forced to read it. So I'm pleased that somebody's read it of their own volition. I think it's, as I said at the start, the issue, the medical issue of concussions and brain health, I feel is pretty well solved in terms of doctors have done great work and in finding all of the medical data that we've needed. But the change is a social change and the culture of sport is unique. And that's the bit that I've always found really interesting. It's not just about the objective medical data, because people aren't objective and they don't react rationally. And so sport's been this really fascinating institution that has developed people in a particular way to fulfill a particular need, primarily born out of the public school systems in the Industrial Revolution, which really is what we see in sport today. And what they needed was a certain type of traditionally men who conformed to authority. They did what they're told. They responded in a really structured way. They used their physical skills. And so sport was the best kind of training ground for that. It's, you know, if you get these guys, you put them around other guys, you teach them to be fast and strong and listen to the people that are in charge of them, whether that's their captains or coaches or the referee. And it was brilliant. It's one of the best things that we could use to create, you know, factory workers of the Industrial Revolution or military personnel that they needed to go off and fight wars. And, you know, when you're told by the person in charge to run that way and fight, you do. And, you know, often we talk about sport as a kind of proxy for a war, and you know, we use the language of war, and so I always found it really interesting. And so we decided to I and a co-author, Professor Eric Anderson, decided to write the book on it and show people, you know, walk them through the steps of how sport developed these skills. And it was great at doing so. I think it also comes with a whole bunch of byproducts and challenges, unintended consequences, whether that's being exclusive, so it's not very inclusive. You know, we've only really seen in the past 50 years real inclusion of women in sport, you know, in the US after Title IX. And it's, if we look at soccer and the professional leagues in England, you know, they're really still in their infancy. And so, yeah, it's just looking at an institution that's made a real important part of many people's lives and our week and the news cycle and our social worlds. And yet lots of people haven't necessarily looked at it through a real critical eye.
You talked about athlete health as both biologic and social. So those can be actually two separate issues. So if we're mapping this on to sports medicine professionals, how do the sports medicine professionals take that into consideration when caring for an athlete?
Yeah, so I think professional sport is both the space where people will meet their best friends for life, but it's also the most cutthroat, competitive space where everybody's fighting for position. And so it's a really difficult space that comes with lots of stress. People are highly strung. There's a lot of suspicion. And that inevitably will be causing challenges for athletes. Hiding injuries is one great example. You know, when you're fighting for position on the team, hiding injuries is a really key thing. Not telling your mates any, you know, if you're going through a particular challenge, you don't want to show that weakness to anybody around you because they're the people that might be trying to push you to the bench. They're the ones that want to get on the field. And so it's just being very aware of this isn't, you know, players are all living this in a social context as well as their performance and physical space. And it's understanding those pressures, those challenges, the social environment that they will be living so that when you're working with them, we don't just take the simple answer of, is everything all right? Yeah, I'm great. They're not going to tell you they're having a problem. We need to find it. We need to dig for it. We need to coax it out of them like we do everything else. You know, it's recognizing that, and they're not being horrible or dishonest because they're doing that. They're playing the game. They're performing. That's their role. That's what we teach them to do. And so, you know, players will hide things. They will not disclose when they're in. And we really need to just work at that. And it's going to be hard and it's going to be difficult. And sports medics need to recognize that just because a player says they're all great, particularly when they're concussed, they're probably not.
Do you think we ever get to that point where athletes advocate for other athletes in the best interest of their health? And if that's the case, what's some of the education that we need to provide for them in order for that to happen?
Yeah, I think if we create a space where we reward athletes looking after each other, I've always found it really curious, particularly in the highest levels of leagues. These guys are assets that are worth a lot of money, and they should all be collectively looking after each other to make the team perform the best they can. And that hasn't traditionally happened. And so I think we need to change the norms of the environment so that athletes are rewarded for looking after their teammates. And that's a real key thing that we expect of them. For concussions and brain health particularly, athletes are the ones that are going to be closest to the impact. And so they're the people who will spot the subtleties. They know their teammates the best. They will have the key pieces of information to pass on to the medic when they come on the field to say, he did this, or this is unusual. And they will notice those subtleties better than anyone. And so they're key players in this space. And so I think the more athletes advocate for one another, the better. You know, I work for a players association, a union. Of course, we would say that. But I think they are starting to. We are seeing more players self-remove from the field. We are seeing players stand up for themselves on various issues now, which is fantastic. And I think that's key. The way that we move this forward is speaking their language. Even again in our space, when we talk about heading guidance, we know that doing a small bout of heading can have a fairly substantial impact upon your decision making, upon your reaction time for 24 to 72 hours. So why on earth would we be doing this the day before a game? It's illogical. It doesn't make sense. And so when we start talking to athletes about the impact upon their performance, you know, if you're concussed, you're a liability. They start to look at it very differently. It's not a health issue. It's a performance issue. And so they start to completely reconceptualize the issue from, I'm not going to stitch up my teammate and get them off the field, to actually, they need to be off the field, not just for them, but for all of us. And I think that's a bit of optimism that we hope will certainly change things.
Now, one of the things that I know in the NFL, salaries aren't guaranteed, which I'm talking to a few former players, Isaiah Kazavinsky and also Ted Johnson about this, is why some of the reason why they were not reporting injuries so they could stay on the field and secure their livelihood. And forgive me if I'm wrong, but is that the same in European soccer where salaries are not guaranteed, or are you starting to see that change in professional soccer?
Yeah, it's in the professional leagues, they're guaranteed. And so we probably have the same issue, but presenting in a different way. And so whilst their salary for the contract they're on is guaranteed, they will still be thinking about their next contract. And so there is still that reluctance, probably less on an immediate or an acute situation, but a much more longer-term planning situation. So I think it's the same issue, but presents differently for us. We also have, and when you start going slightly down the league, so to what we call the National League system, where it's very much a semi-professional game, players will be paid by participating each week. That's where it becomes what we call the Wild West. And the practices that you see there are worrying. It's players will play on through injuries because ultimately, like Isaiah would have told you, they're worried about getting their paycheck at the end of the week or their playing bonus or whatever else it might be. And so, yeah, I think and the more protections we can put in place to help those players, the better. But thankfully, right all the way through our professional game system, we have what's called a standard player contract that was negotiated a long time ago. And players will be, ultimately, whilst they're injured and still in contract, they will be paid.
All right, we have something called the lightning round, where we just ask very quick questions and get very quick answers.
What gives you the most optimism about the future of brain health in football?
I think the fact that we're seeing professional players head the ball way less in training. 50 years ago, they were heading it hundreds of times per week. Now we're seeing them head it a dozen times per week. And that just tracks that they'll be heading the ball way less. And so hopefully their risk of neurodegenerative disease later in life will be much lower.
What's something about sports culture that you would like to see eliminated?
Only one thing.
As many as you want.
Oh, God.
It's like you wrote a book on this.
Yeah. Chapter one. I think for me, it's that cutthroat competitive space that leads to so many other issues, whether it's on concussion, whether it's on injury, whether it's on... I think it's just such a high pressure, cutthroat space that it's just so toxic for so many.
A habit every clinician should adopt when evaluating head injuries.
Assume it's a concussion. Always assume it's a concussion. And absolutely test that. If you've got any inkling or any worry, niggle, I'm not sure, just say it's a concussion.
That's great quote right there. Always assume it's a concussion, because you're right. I mean, if you assume the worst, then you're the most vigilant.
So I'll give you a little sidebar here. We had in the state of Massachusetts, we had written a policy back in 2012 on brain health or concussion health for youth athletes. And if there's a suspected head injury, they are out without a doubt. So they are out of competition until they're assessed or diagnosed by an athlete trainer, physician, nurse practitioner, and then gone through a return to play protocol. So same thing, what you're saying, it's just best interest of the athlete. It's about them, not you.
And like the reality, if you get it wrong, if you diagnose someone with a concussion and you're wrong, they're going to miss 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. If you don't diagnose someone with a concussion and they did have it, who knows what happened? The best case is that they'll have prolonged symptoms. Worst case is second impact syndrome and you'll be in a coroner's court explaining why you didn't take them off.
Yeah, well said.
Those are all great answers. I like the always assume it's a concussion. I think that's amazing.
A research area you are most excited about?
I think the faster we can diagnose CTE in the living, the quicker we can start to look for cures and therapies that help. You asked earlier on about what we can do for former athletes with these concerns. And other than provide them with support, we're limited. And that feels pretty shit for me. So mm-hmm. We need to find ways that we can absolutely help them, whether that's through therapeutic approaches or through some kind of cure, medication, whatever it might be. But we won't get there until we can diagnose this in the living.
I like it. If sports systems are designed around long-term health rather than performance, what would need to change first?
Oh, God. I think it would be, if it was designed around health other than performance, we would have mass participation. We would be really inclusive. And we would have no, ultimately, the commercial interests would have to come out of it. It wouldn't be viable. And so we wouldn't be watching the NFL and Olympics, and we'd be doing things like, we have what's called Park Run here in the UK, where every week just random people turn up and there's no race. It's like everybody does 5K, and at the end, everybody gets coffee and chats, and it's social. If it takes you an hour to do 5K, everyone's still like, great, that's brilliant. Ultimately, getting more people doing 5Ks, whether it takes them 14 minutes or an hour and a half, doesn't really matter. It's getting them to do it. And I think that would be the biggest change for health, is moving away from the commercial interests, the competition structures, and back to mass participation. I can't see it.
Sport for fun, not for money.
Yeah, it's... And it, like, I always just, you know, if you go past 5-year-old kids that are just playing, like, that's what sport is. You know, they don't care about the rules. They don't need a referee. They aren't interested in anything else. They're just running around, having fun, laughing with their mates. Like, yeah. Adults like doing that too, funnily enough. It's that's what we all enjoy. You know, it's when we put all these competition rules and structures, and you have to train 8 times a week, and then you get injured because you've trained 8 times in a week, and then that gets you down. That's where it all goes wrong. Let's just play and have fun.
Final question, I promise.
Keep going.
What gives you optimism about the future of brain health and football, and what would success look like 10 years from now?
Success for us is, and we always talk about, we want to make dementia in football history, and not in the sense of, you know, it's so profound that it becomes written in the history books. We want it to be history. I'm sick of meeting families of footballers that have passed away with neurodegenerative conditions that have lived horrendous journeys. Their stories are horrendous. It's horrifying. It's brutal. And we need to stop that. And so future generations of football players, I'd like to meet their families because of some other reason, not because they've had to endure dementia.
I hope, wish you well with all of your endeavors and trying to get that culture change, that shift.
We'll get there.
Yeah.
Might take a while, but wait, you know, we're optimistic. I think in football, it's possible. In your football, I have no idea what you'd do.
It's quite interesting you say that, because, I mean, 15 years ago, we all thought that was never going to happen in the NFL. They were going to reduce hitting in practices, and they were going to advocate more for the player. And they, again, when Ted Johnson came out with his New York Times interview, that changed everything. It opened everybody's eyes. And knowing him personally, we had just interviewed him last week. We had gone through and almost kind of relived that whole process that he had gone through. And I remember him talking about, you know, days where he didn't want to leave his house, you know? So for us, like, to live that as medical professionals and working with those athletes, we saw the paradigm shift, which was amazing, that they reduced all these impacts in practice where most of the injuries are occurring. And they were now putting the pieces in place to help to better understand the injury and then use the medical teams to be able to help advocate and do the right thing for the athlete. So I'm hoping that that's the same type of, maybe not have someone like that come out and say they've suffered like that, but to people to look at that history and say, this is what we need to do for our footballers to make sure that they have a life outside of soccer when they retire.
And I think, you know, it's hard when you're in the thick of it to reflect on the success. And it's only 20 years ago when the first modern cases of CTE were being diagnosed in American football players. The first soccer player was 2014. You know, that's a decade ago. The journey we've come from, nobody having any idea about the long-term effects of heading the ball or concussions or repeated impacts, to where we are today. The science has moved forward. The public awareness has moved forward. The training of doctors, and there's so much to be optimistic about. It's just how do we keep moving at that pace so that ultimately we all want a day where this is all redundant because we've solved the problem. You know, success is doctors not needing to know about the long-term neurodegenerative conditions associated with sport, because there won't be any. And so it's how do we continue that kind of full circle to solving the problem.
I was at the concussion symposium, the first one that Chris Nowinski spoke about CTE. And we were sitting there as medical professionals listening to him. And he talked about Dr. Omalu's research. And we're looking at him like, what is this guy talking about? Like, what's this CTE? And we all, after the conference, were like, how are we going to assess this? Like, how are we going to be able to assess these athletes? And who's going to buy in? And who's going to listen to us saying we have to sit the athlete down? And now, fast forward 20 years, right? And the impact he's had in the brain bank, and you starting the Concussion Legacy Foundation in the UK, I mean, speaks volumes to what he's done, and all the work he put in has just changed our thinking on how we better treat the athlete and listen to the athlete, but then also educate them, their families, the stakeholders. So it's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think everybody still looks to him at every conference and thinks, what the hell is he talking about? but thankfully, you know, 8 out of 9 or 8 out of 10 times he's usually onto something. And I think he was a massive early adopter, saw what was coming down the track. And, you know, whilst I think some people didn't want to hear the message and some people didn't understand the message, I think, you know, in the space of 20, 15 years, the change has been phenomenal. And that can only be applauded. You know, it's, but we've got a long way to go. There's still tons to be done. You know, we had we've just had a paper sent back to us that we'd submitted a few weeks back, and 3 out of the 4 reviewers are brilliant, and then one person's like, CTE is not a real condition, and you're like, I thought we'd got past those days. You know, like, maybe you should search some literature from the last decade, and you might have a different view, but you know, there are still some very late adopters that we need to still shift.
Definitely.
That's great.
Well, thank you, Dr. Ira White. We appreciate all that you're doing over in the UK, and hopefully that we can continue these conversations and more people understand the importance of this condition, or we kind of call it an epidemic, because it's widespread across the entire world, and it's not just focused on one sport, it's on multiple sports. So good luck with everything you guys are doing.
No, thank you. And I agree. I think, you know, the work that's happened in the US to raise awareness of this, we're pleased it's now spreading to other countries, whether that's the UK or Australia. And I think it won't be long before we're seeing this issue being discussed everywhere in the world. It's only a matter of time.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.